The Old Testament clearly states that the way to peace is through reliance on God as an outside power. Giving up trust in God and looking instead to yourself could be very dangerous. It could also be heresy. A few clues indicate that I can risk a different approach, however. In the Bible, one finds such verses as, "Seek ye the kingdom of heaven within," and the means of going inward, chiefly meditation and silent contemplation, are not that far removed from prayer. A biological response lies behind restful awareness, no matter what faith we clothe it in. In the Hindu tradition, going inward begins a spiritual quest that will eventually end in enlightenment. The spiritual properties of mantras, a word repeated mentally while breathing slowly in and out, have two bases. Some orthodox Hindus would say that every mantra is a version of God's name, while others would claim, and this is very close to quantum physics, that the vibration of the mantra is the key, the frequency of brain activity in the cerebral cortex. The mantra forms a feedback loop as the brain produces the sound, listens to it, and then responds with a deeper level of attention. A person could use any of the five senses to enter this feedback loop. The whole intent is to go past the senses in order to find their source. In all cases, the source is a finer state of brain activity. The theory is that mental activity contains its own mechanism for becoming more and more refined until complete silence is experienced. At that point, one's awareness crosses the quantum boundary. The material plane has been left behind. We are now in the region where spiritual activity commands its own laws. The argument persists that a brain learning to calm down may be comforting, but it isn't spiritual. There really is no fundamental disagreement going on. The cerebral cortex produces thought by using energy in the form of photons. Their interaction takes place on the quantum level, which means that every thought could be traced back to its source at a deeper level. No spiritual thoughts stand apart on their own. We are kept on the material level because our attention is pulled outward rather than inward. There is no doubt that people resist the whole notion of God being an inner phenomenon. The vast majority of the world's faithful are firmly committed to stages 1 and 2, believing in a God up there, outside ourselves. Yet its importance is eloquently stated in the medieval document known as the Cloud of Unknowing, written anonymously in the 14th century. The author tells us that God, the angels, and all the saints take greatest delight when a person begins to do inner work. However, none of this is apparent at first. God has no presence, emotionally or intellectually. The cloud of unknowing is all we have to go on. The only solution, the writer informs us, is perseverance. We are advised to go into a cloud of forgetting about anything other than the silence of the inner world. This makes perfect sense once we realize that the restful awareness response, which contains no thoughts, is being advocated. The step the writer took was a brave one under the weight of priests, cathedrals, and church laws. But it would be a brave step today as well, because people want a God they can see and touch and talk to. Consider how radical the argument really is, as revealed in the next section of the book. In this work, it profits little or nothing to think upon the worthiness of God, or upon the saints and angels in heaven. It is far better to think upon the naked being of God. This naked being is awareness without content, pure spirit. As with any stage, this is one you enter, then explore. It can be a bleak place at first, marked by loss of all the rituals and comforts of organized faith. Our anonymous writer emphasizes over and over that delight and love will eventually arise out of silence. The inner work is done for only one purpose, to feel the love of God, and there is no other way to achieve it. Every stage of inner growth is a hard one. A clash of values confronts everyone on the threshold of stage 3. Good is measured by remaining centered in the self, which brings clarity and calm. Evil is measured by disturbance to that clarity. It brings confusion, chaos, and inability to see the truth. 50 years ago, the sociologist David Reisman noted that the vast majority are outer-directed and the small minority inner-directed. Outer direction comes from what others think of you. You crave approval and bend to the needs of conformity. Inner direction is rooted in a stable self that cannot be shaken. An inner-directed person is free of the need for approval, making it much easier for him to question prevailing opinions. Being inner-directed doesn't make you religious, but the religion of the inner-directed is stage 3. Jesus wanted his disciples to be in the world, but not of it. He wanted them to be both detached and engaged. Detached in the sense that no one could grab their souls. Engaged in the sense that they remained motivated to lead a worthy life. This is the balancing act of stage 3, and many people find it hard to manage. This is how the writer of The Cloud of Unknowing describes spiritual work. Who is it that calls it nothing? Surely it is our outer man and not our inner. Our inner man calls it all, for it teaches him to understand all things, bodily or spiritual, without any special knowledge of one thing in itself. This is a remarkable description of how silence works. Those who achieve inner silence are also thinking in the ordinary way, but the thought takes place against a background of non-thought. The mind is full of a kind of knowing that could speak to us about everything, yet it has no words. Therefore, we seek this knowingness in the background. If you keep to your plan, rejecting outward answers over and over, eventually your seeking bears fruit. During this whole time, your work inside is private, but outer existence has to go on. Thus, the balancing act Jesus referred to as being in the world, but not of it. Or as we are stating it, being detached and engaged at the same time. In stage 3, a person finds that he is autonomous. By breaking free of social pressures, he can be himself. Yet there is a risk of fatalism, a feeling that being free is just a form of isolation with no hope of influencing others. How can another person, someone not at this stage, understand what it means? Mahatma Gandhi, because he had renounced the outer trappings, couldn't be grabbed in the usual places. Those in power couldn't threaten him with losing his job, house, family, or even with imprisonment and death. They tried all of these means anyway. Detachment renders the use of power impotent. You validate yourself from within, and this equates with God's blessing. The pull towards spirit is real. For all the outer sacrifices, something seems to have been gained. At this moment, there's a period of adjustment as the person accommodates to a new world so different from that of every day. Stage 3 is not about becoming an introvert. That is the great temptation, especially for those who misinterpret the words going inward and inner silence. Someone who wants to shrink from the world can use as his excuse that spirituality should be inward. Someone who feels pessimistic can find comfort in rejecting the whole material world. Introversion is not a spiritual state, however. I know one man whose basic attitude is disgust with the world. It can be very draining to be around this man, but he sees himself as a good Buddhist. His path of renunciation really amounts to rejection. To be involved in the world is a muddy, sometimes dispiriting business. God enfolds the whole creation, not just the nice parts. If you start out by rejecting this or that, how will you end up accepting it? True renunciation is quite different. It consists of realizing that there is a reality behind the mask of the material world. The richest man in the world could be a renunciate if he has the proper insights, while a greedy, selfish monk could fall very short of renunciation. Stage 3 has to do with allegiance. Do you give your allegiance to the inner world or the outer? It will be in the fire of experience that real answers come. Stage 4. God the Redeemer. Intuitive response. The higher stages of spirituality seem mysterious because there's nowhere to go beyond silence. We have to look at what silence can grow into, which is wisdom. Psychologists are well aware that wisdom is a real phenomenon. If you pose a battery of problems to subjects who span a range of ages, the older ones will predictably give wiser answers than the younger. It doesn't matter really what the problem is. Wisdom is a perspective. Just as stage 3 sees the birth of a peaceful God, stage 4 sees the birth of a wise God. God the Redeemer begins to take back all the judgments that weighed down life. Therefore, his wisdom creates a sense of being loved and nurtured. In this way, the loneliness of the inner world begins to soften. To a psychologist, wisdom is correlated with age and experience, but something much deeper is involved. Spiritual masters speak of second attention. First attention is concerned with the task at hand. Second attention looks beyond, somehow viewing life from a deeper perspective. From this source, wisdom is derived, and the God of stage 4 appears only when second attention has been cultivated. First attention organizes the surface of life. Second attention organizes the deeper levels. The God of stage 4 enters one's life only after you make friends with the subconscious. Therapists have an exercise for this, which consists of imagining yourself in a dark cave. You have entered to find the perfect mentor who is waiting for you at the end of a tunnel. You begin to walk toward him, feeling calm and expectant. As you get near the end of the tunnel, a room opens up and you see your mentor with his back to you. He slowly turns around. This is the point at which you are supposed to realize who, out of everyone you have ever met, will be facing you. No gender is implied in the role of mentor. The original mentor, who appeared as tutor and guide to the son of Ulysses, took a male shape but was actually Athena, goddess of wisdom. Myths around the world include heroes who speak directly to gods. Today we are more inhibited. A gut feeling is as close to the Oracle of Delphi as many people are going to get. That we can bypass reason to gain insight is certainly true. I think the two hemispheres of the brain are likely to be the source of first and second attention. We can all intuit and reason at the same time. Doctors have all met patients who know in advance whether or not they have cancer, or whether a surgery will turn out well. The big question of stage 4 is how we can learn to trust second attention. Once you start identifying with the knower, that part of yourself that is intuitive, wise, and perfectly at home in the quantum world, then God assumes a new shape. He turns from all-powerful to all-knowing. You will never trust your intuition until you identify with it. At the earliest stages of inner growth, a person is esteemed who belongs to the group and upholds its values. If the knower within tries to object, he is stifled. Intuition actually becomes an enemy because it has a nasty habit of saying things you aren't supposed to hear. A person who has arrived at stage 4 long ago gave up group values. The enticements of war, competition, the stock market, fame, and wealth have faded. If you are thrilled by the following lines from the great Persian mystic Rumi, you definitely understand how the inner world can be more thrilling than anything outside. When I die, I will soar with angels. And when I die to the angels, what I shall become, you cannot imagine. In stage 4, the emptiness of outward life is rendered irrelevant because a new voyage has commenced. The wise are not sitting around contemplating how wise they are. They are flying through space and time, guided on a soul journey that nothing can impede. The hunger to be alone, characteristic of anyone in stage four, comes from sheer suspense, to find out what comes next in the unfolding of the soul's drama. The word redemption conveys only a pale sense of how all-involving this whole expedition is. There is much more to the knower within than just being free from sin. You don't have to be perfect to try to reach the angels, but you do have to be able to live with yourself and keep your own company for long stretches of time. A sense of sin hinders that ability. In stage three, the inner world evidences little activity. The inner world comes alive in stage four. One begins to understand how reality works, and human nature starts to unfold its secrets. Here are some examples. There are no victims. Random events are guided by a higher wisdom. Chaos is an illusion. There is total order to all events. Fate becomes a pressing issue. The person in stage four has experienced enough instances where an invisible hand must be at work. The instances may be small, but there is no turning away from them. After paying enough attention, always the key word, you begin to see that events form patterns. You see that they hold lessons or messages or signs. And then you see that these outer events are actually symbols for inner events. When wise people declare that all is justly ordered, their listeners remain baffled. What about wars, fires, random murders, and so on? How could the poet Browning have the audacity to claim that God is in his heaven and all's right with the world? He found out from a God not to be met until stage four. Here is a good place to ask what the inner knower actually knows. As we commonly define it, knowledge is experience that has been recorded in memory. Wisdom consists of being comfortable with certainty and uncertainty. Strangely, wisdom often arrives only after thinking is over. Simplicity dawns. In the presence of a wise person, one can feel an interior calm, alive and breathing its own atmosphere. The New Testament calls this the peace that passes understanding, because it goes beyond thinking. No amount of mental churning will get you there. The inner world has its storms, but much more terrible are its doubts. No one can get very far in stage four if there is self-doubt, because the self is all there is to rely on. Outside support has lost its reassurance. In ordinary life, such a loss is dreaded. In stage four, however, all moorings are loosed. Since infancy, we have all gained security from having one mother, one father, our own friends, one spouse, a family of our own. This sense of attachment reflects a lifelong need for support. In stage four, the whole support structure melts away. The person is left to get support internally, from the self. Self-acceptance becomes the way to God. It is a kind of expansion that no longer needs to distinguish between me and you, yours and mine. If that involves giving up the old support systems, the person willingly pays the price. The soul journey is guided by an inner passion that demands its own fulfillment. From the outside, someone in stage four seems to have opted out. With no social bonds left, there is really no social role either. The deepest insights are usually not socially acceptable. Therefore, they are seen as insane, heretical, or criminal. In stage four, good is clarity of mind, which brings the ability to see the truth. Evil is blindness or ignorance, which makes the truth impossible to see. Truth becomes a quest from which no one can deter you. Goodness means remaining true to your quest. Evil is being drawn away from it. In the case of Socrates, even a sentence of death left him impervious. When offered an escape, he refused. His evil would have been to betray himself. By drinking his cup of hemlock, Socrates died a traitor to the state, who had upheld a total commitment to himself. This was a gesture of ultimate goodness. I have saved the topic of sin until we understood the inner world better. Sin is a stubborn issue. Because no one was perfect in childhood, we all carry the imprints of guilt and shame. Sin can be defined as a wrong that leaves an impression. In the East, any act that leaves an impression is called karma. This is a much broader definition than sin, and it includes no moral blame. Karma can be right or wrong and still leave an imprint. The God of stage 4 sees sinners and saints in the same light, and all actions as equal. This valuation is scandalous. Society exists to draw the line between right and wrong, not to erase it. When Jesus spared the hundreds of Jewish laws down to 2, put no other gods before God, and love your neighbor as yourself, the good people around him assumed he was either crazy or criminal. In actuality, he was extremely responsible. As you sow, so shall you reap. Jesus stated the law of karma quite succinctly. He pointed to a higher spiritual rule: your actions today define your future tomorrow. This dynamic turns out to be more important than identifying sin. What would forgiveness of sin amount to? Finding the answer is the life challenge of this stage. A redeemed soul sees itself as new and unblemished. This state of innocence would be impossible, according to the law of karma, for the cycle of sowing and reaping never ends. In theory, at least, the answer is simple. You redeem your soul by turning to God. God transcends karma because He alone isn't in the cosmos. One doesn't need to repeal the law of karma at all. The instant they wake up in the morning, a saint and a sinner are in the same place. This place stands outside reward and punishment. In stage 4, your challenge is to find this place, hold on to it, and live there. When you have accomplished this task, duality is gone. In Christian terms, your soul is redeemed and returned to innocence. The inner quest is all about undoing attachments. These do not come free all at once, nor is every attachment equal. It is entirely normal to arrive at profound insights and still feel as ashamed as a little child over certain things. Stage 4 requires new tactics. No one outside yourself can offer absolution. To get past an obstacle requires your own insight. There is only one insight and one delusion in stage 4. The insight is that everything is all right. The delusion is that we have made unforgivable mistakes. In the eyes of God, all souls are innocent. We are deluded to keep holding on to past mistakes. They will be washed away in good time. Every stage of inner growth contains more freedom than the one before. Breaking free from sin is a great accomplishment in stage 4, but the price of redemption is constant vigilance. It takes more than an act of will to escape notions of right and wrong. The process has to continue without deception. There is a lot of work to do in the form of meditation, self-reflection, taking responsibility. Every step forward must be tested, and the temptation to go backward persists until the very end. The whole process of being true to yourself brings as its reward a higher level of awareness. At this level, the issues of duality have been left behind. And when that happens, the subjective feeling is one of being redeemed. Stage 5. God the Creator. Creative Response. There is a level of creativity that goes far beyond anything we have discussed so far. It dawns when intuition becomes so powerful, it must break out into the environment. This super intuition controls events and makes wishes come true, as though an artist is working not in paint and canvas, but in the raw material of life. Now the time has come when fate no longer has to be hidden from view. This happens when a person gives up all notions of accident, coincidence, and random events, and instead claims responsibility for each and every incident, however trivial. Events no longer happen out there, but are guided by one's own intentions. Stage 5 joins the individual to God in a partnership as co-creators. This is the most intimate God we have projected so far, because of a quality that is the key to stage 5, openness. God the Creator is willing to share His power with His creation. Our minds have to grasp just what it means to have all of time and space at our disposal. The conviction of sin has deprived us of our own creativity. In stage 5, at long last, there is no trace of original sin, no imperfection to atone for. If I see myself outside the process, then I am not a co-creator. To be in alliance with God, you must uphold your side of the partnership, which involves some very specific beliefs. You have to see yourself at the center of the creative process. You have to accept responsibility for all outcomes. You have to identify with a larger self than this limited physical body. Many people on the spiritual path willingly accept one or more of these beliefs, but the deciding factor is whether you live them out. This is a stage of power, and that implies getting straight about whether you deserve to wield it. It is surmised that when people are in a creative state, the cerebral cortex first establishes restful awareness. Unlike other periods of relaxation, this state is on the lookout for something, a stroke of inspiration, and when it occurs, a spike of activity is registered by the mind. Truly creative people tend to introduce a question into their minds and then wait for the solution to arrive, hence the necessity of going into a relaxed mode. We are speaking of quantum creativity here. As soon as we start approaching the miraculous, the quantum world has to return. There is no other viable way to explain such powers. There are no miracles, an Indian master once remarked, unless you look at all of life as a miracle. If I look outside my window, I can see an old, gnarled oak. To a neutrino, which can pass through the entire earth in a few millionths of a second, solid objects are as vaporous as fog. To a druid priest, the tree would be sacred. To a logger, it is just a day's work. Take any quality the tree might have, and it changes according to the perceiver. The most important point, there is no tree out there. No sights, sounds, textures, tastes, or smells exist without a brain to create them. We are so accustomed to accepting the world as a given that we overlook our creative role in it. When one person is able to create outcomes in his life, while another person merely experiences random events, the difference is a choice not taken. In your mind's eye, see a scene from your childhood, back at the beach, for example. You can get absorbed in the scene, feeling the sun's heat, the surf. There is no essential difference between doing this and actually going to the beach. The brain is shaping virtual photons into a pattern of experience. When Jesus turned water into wine, he used the same ability, only he obliterated the arbitrary line between imaginary results and real ones. There is still a small separation between the individual mind and its source at the virtual level. Stage 5 is much like being the most privileged pupil of Mozart or Leonardo da Vinci. At earlier stages of inner growth, it would seem blasphemous to undertake this kind of relationship. Earlier stages did not desire or permit such intimacy. But by stage 5, a person realizes that God is not a being with desires. The inhibitions that hold us back, and this holds true at every level of growth, exist inside ourselves. God sees all choices with the same eye. His vision includes no judgment. When a person realizes this, God suddenly opens his deepest secrets, not because God has changed his mind, but because our perspective has. The master-apprentice metaphor stretches only so far. As a co-creator, you are expected to do more than just live and have random desires as most people do. In stage 5, the process is about becoming the author of your own life. How is that done? Before you become the author of your own life, you feel inadequate and powerless. Outside circumstances seem to have the upper hand. After you assume authorship of your own life, outcomes are never in doubt. Events still unfold unpredictably, yet you know that you are adequate to meet them. The adventure is to uncover the creative solutions that most appeal to you. You gain authorship based on your own inclinations, with no outside help and no second opinions. You can tell if you're in stage 5 by the way you get what you want. If you rely almost entirely on an internal process, then you are, with a minimum of effort, a co-creator of reality. If we get down to specifics, the act of creation is reducible to one ingredient, intention. There are no magic tricks to making a thought come true. You just intend a thing and it happens. When highly successful people are interviewed, many times they repeat the same formula. I had a dream and I stuck with it, because I was certain that it would come true. Of course, there's a great deal of work to be done to arrive at any great accomplishment, but it's just what you need to do to get to the goal. Intention lies at the heart of the process. To break this down into specific behavior, the following qualities can be seen in people who have mastered the art of intention. They are not attached to the past or how things should turn out. They adapt quickly to errors and mistakes. They are alert to tiny signals. They have a good connection between mind and body. They have no trouble embracing ambiguity. They remain patient, trusting the universe to bring results. They make karmic connections and are able to see the meaning in chance events. Making any idea come to life always involves intention. If you have a flash of genius, that flash remains inside your head until it materializes. The issue is how it gets materialized. There are efficient ways and inefficient ways. The most efficient way is shown to us by the mind itself. If I ask you to think of an elephant, the image just appears in your head, though millions of neurons had to coordinate this image using chemical and electromagnetic energy. The intention and the outcome are one. All intervening steps remain invisible. Now consider a larger intention, such as going to medical school. Between having this idea and fulfilling it are many steps, and these are not internal at all. Raising tuition money, passing exams, etc. Yet just like the image of the elephant, each of these steps depends upon brain operations being invisibly coordinated. You think, move, and act using intention. You expect the process of becoming a doctor to unfold with the least effort, unhindered by obstacles. The boundary between in here and out there is softened. All events take place in the mind field first, and then exhibit their outward manifestation. Your role is to remain as sensitive and alert as possible. The turning points in life arrive as small signals at first. So being vigilant is a major part of spiritual evolution. God always speaks in silence, but sometimes the silence is louder than at other times. I often hear people quote Joseph Campbell's advice to follow your bliss. In stage 5, bliss becomes better defined as inspiration. Rather than having intentions that originate with your ego, you feel that you're called to do something highly meaningful. The sense of being outside yourself is often present, and as God takes over, the fruition of your desires feels blissful, whereas the fulfillment of ego desires often surprises us by feeling very flat. Ask anyone how they feel 6 months after winning the lottery. To be inspired is a high state of attainment. Four decades ago, the psychologist Abraham Maslow first spoke of peak experiences, his terminology for a breakthrough into expanded consciousness. A peak experience shares many qualities with inspiration, including feelings of bliss and being outside oneself. The conscious mind receives a supercharged burst from the unconscious. And even though this may happen only once in a lifetime, that feeling of empowerment can influence the course of events for many years. Although Maslow theorized that peak experiences gave glimpses of the real norms of the psyche out of the whole population, Maslow and like-minded researchers could barely find 5% who even temporarily made such a transition. Such self-actualized individuals felt as a normal experience that they were safe, confident, full of esteem for themselves and others, and deeply appreciative of what life brought to them. To redefine human nature in such positive terms seemed unrealistic. Freud had already laid down his law that human nature contains hidden tendencies that break out like caged monsters. Maslow had to admit that tremendous obstacles stand in our way. Most people are too needy to grow. Need comes in four levels, he said. The first is physical, the need to feed and clothe ourselves. Next comes the need for safety, followed by the need to be loved, and finally by the need for self-esteem. Only at the top does a person get the chance to feel self-actualized. When someone turns to God in order to feel safe or to be loved, need is the real motivation. In any event, God doesn't intervene to rectify the situation. To be driven by need is just how life works. To bring back the sacred, it must accomplish something that love, security, self-esteem, or good fortune cannot. When we are inspired, we don't act from need at all. You don't have to be spiritually advanced to feel triumphant when you reach the top of Everest. Spiritual advancement shows up when the small things carry a share of blessing too. Someone in stage 5 sees grace in all things. It is inevitable that no one in stage 5 can make every wish come true, and bad things in terms of pain and failure continue to occur. This stokes the fear of a fall from grace. Stage 5 is not a magic haven. On the other hand, these setbacks are only temporary. When things don't go right, failure is not the issue, much less evil. Being a co-creator implies complete mastery, and that hasn't yet been attained. Common unhappiness comes from lower needs being unmet. Evil comes from all being unmet. Stage 5 amplifies our power so much that misusing it would amount to evil. Leaders who have a hypnotic hold over their followers have a source of power that crosses the boundaries of identity. In some way, the leader actually infiltrates his listener. The evil that results can be traced back to a lower level of awareness, exactly the thing most feared. There is more than one way to arrive at any goal, and not all are sacred. If we assume that our quantum model holds good, then nothing is unholy. Beyond right and wrong, the Creator may permit us to explore anything He has allowed to exist. In stage 5, although one may be able to make almost any wish come true, the ones that should come true matter more. We are guided to increase bliss, love, and charity to others. An inner sense of rightness must be cultivated. Ego must be diminished. The larger will that rules events always tries to make itself known. If you align with it, the path through this phase is smooth. Artists go inward and an image appears, at first faint but growing. If the inspiration is genuine, this impression never fades. Creator, creation, and the process of creating are fused. In stage 5, the fusing isn't complete. There is the danger of trying to take over the process, which severs the alliance with God. Struggles with self-importance can last a long time, but they always end once the person finds a way to give more of the responsibility back to God. In other words, the way to power is to give up power. This is the great lesson the ego is confronted with in this phase. Stage 6, God of Miracles, Visionary Response. I once read in an inspirational book the following. This is a recreational universe. Your ability to play in it is limited only by how much you can appreciate. It occurred to me that the world's greatest saints and masters may simply be enjoying themselves. For all their miracles, or because of them, we think of saints as being without fun or loving relationships or sexual impulses. It's impossible to imagine a saint with money and a good car. In stage 6, all of these assumptions are tested. Full-blown miracles are now possible. For example, a nun of the late Victorian era named Sister Marie of Jesus Crucified, one Miriam Buardi, had the alarming habit of suddenly swooping up to the tops of trees, where she flitted from branch to branch. This feat embarrassed Miriam, since she had no way of predicting or controlling her ecstasies, and on one occasion, 8 were observed in total, Miriam timidly asked her companion to turn her back. "Why do you rise like this?" the Mother Superior interrogated her. "The Lamb, meaning Christ, carries me in his hands," Miriam answered. "If I obey quickly, the tree becomes like this," and she put her hand close to the ground. The most mystical of the Gospels is the book of John. Consider its description of creation. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Something like the following is meant. Before there was time and space, a faint vibration existed outside the cosmos. This vibration had everything contained in it, all universes, all events, all time and space. Divine intelligence was compressed in this Word, and the Word transformed itself into the energy and matter of the universe. In stage 6, a person returns to the Word in all its primordial power to discover the source. Behind everything is a vibration. Not in the sense of a sound or an energy wave, because those are material, but a mother vibration at the virtual level that includes everything. In India, the sound took the name Om, and it is believed that meditating on the sound will unlock all the mother's secrets. What brain mechanism, if any, gives visions of God and makes miracles possible? Some researchers have speculated that the two hemispheres of the brain become completely balanced in higher states of consciousness. This elusive brain function I will call the visionary response. It is marked by the ability to change energy states outside the body, causing objects and events to be transformed. No brain researcher has come within miles of describing the necessary shift that must be achieved to perform a miracle. In our culture, the human heart is seen as a machine that wears out over time. We fix it through mechanical repairs. So when we find out that widowers have a higher incidence of sudden death from heart attacks, the fact that sadness can kill doesn't compute very well. One is reminded of the psychic surgeons of the Philippines, who seem to penetrate a patient's body with their hands and pull out all manner of bloody tissue, none of it anything that would be seen inside a body at autopsy. In many cases, patients report that they can actually feel the surgeon's fingers, and dramatic recoveries have been reported. In quantum terms, we can offer an explanation. As we know, any object can be reduced to packets of energy. The medicine man turns a mental image into physical reality, and in that vision, the new result emerges. What he's trying to alter are the energy patterns that have become distorted, thus causing the disease. He makes the patient enter into altered reality with him. At the level of ordinary life, the events remain baffling, hence the widespread skepticism over holy apparitions, psychic surgeons, and jungle medicine men. But the visionary response describes another level of consciousness where energy patterns are shifting with every thought. The fact that these shifts change the outer world is amazing to us, but natural to the person in stage 6. Starting with the physical body in stage 1 and steadily moving to less physical planes, now we arrive at nothing but awareness. My identity floats in a quantum fog as photons wink in and out of existence. Of the million ways you could define enlightenment, identifying with the light is a good one. Jesus could easily have been literal when he declared to his disciples, "You are the light of the world." Miracle working is accessible before sainthood. When you see any image in your brain, you're shifting reality. The difference between you and a miracle worker is that you do not create a strong enough force field to make your mental image project itself onto the outer world. From the larger perspective, no one has the power to keep God out totally. We can only open or close our acceptance of the light. No matter what documentation is offered for miracles, many people will say, "But have you seen one yourself?" I have a cousin who was struck with a virulent case of hepatitis C a few years ago. He received every sort of treatment, including interferon, but his platelet counts dropped alarmingly and his viral count from the hepatitis soared. A few months ago, he turned to an energy healer in India, who passed his hands over my cousin's liver to extract the disease entity. In a short time, his platelet counts were back to normal, and there were no symptoms of any disease. To me, this is a miracle. It seems to be a teachable one as well. You can take most people and school them successfully in the art of healing touch, which requires a practitioner to run her hands over the body a few inches over the skin to feel where there are energy hotspots, detected as a patch of warm air over that region. The practitioner then moves this energy to dispel it, and in many cases some healing is achieved, usually in the form of more rapid recovery than from conventional treatments. Things are real in the quantum world if you make them real, and that is done by manipulating light. Any miracle may be within reach if only we begin to alter our conception of who we are and how our minds work. When he realizes that he is bathed in light, the feeling that comes over a miracle worker is one of intense love. When Jesus said, "I am the light," he meant, "I am totally in God's force field." No one could claim that stage 6 alone reveals God's love. We are all in the force field of love, but in early stages of spiritual growth, its power is weak. We waver and can easily be thrown off in other directions. Only after years of cleaning out negative emotions and old conditioning does a person realize that God's force is immensely powerful. When this occurs, nothing can pull the mind away from love. Love as a personal emotion is transmuted into cosmic energy. It takes a quantum leap in consciousness to love God all the time. Yet when the leap is finally made, there is really no God to love, not as a separate object. The fusion of the worshipper and what he worships is nearly complete, but that is enough to animate everything in creation. This is the love, Rumi declares, that brings our body to life. Sometimes God is felt with ecstasy, but just as often there can be pain, anguish, and confusion. This mixture of feelings reminds us that two entities are coming into conjunction. One is spirit, the other is body. God's presence overcomes the most intense conditions of pain and suffering. Grace offers constant support in everyday life. If God is like a force field in stage 6, grace is his magnetic pull. Grace adapts itself to each person. We make our choices, some of which are good for us, some bad, and then grace shapes the results. When you feel you have been touched by grace, this is your clue that God exists and cares about what happens to you. Whether operating on the level of a saint or a criminal, grace is the ingredient that saves karma from being heartlessly mechanical. A thief who commits robbery 100 times would seem to be set on his course, but at any given moment he has the opportunity to stop and mend his ways. The impulse to move towards spirit is the result of grace. It is so difficult to be good that eventually a person must give up. This is a realization that arrives in stage 6. In Christianity, the struggle is predestined to end with the victory of good, since God is more powerful than Satan. But in Hinduism, the forces of light and darkness will battle eternally. In stage 6, a person is visionary enough to see this. He still retains a conception of good. It is the force of evolution that lies behind birth, growth, love, truth, and beauty. He also retains a conception of evil. It is the force that opposes evolution. We would call it entropy, leading to decomposition, dissolution, inertia. However, God created both because both are needed. God is in the evil as much as in the good. The saint sees the sinner inside himself, just as the saint accepts evil as calmly as any other occurrence. The working out of the soul stands apart, and at some point the dance of good and evil becomes one.